This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وعلى آله وصحبه أجمعين. اللهم علمنا ما ينفعنا وانفعنا بما علمتنا وزدنا علما سبحانك اللهم لا علم لنا إلا ما علمتنا إنك أنت العليم الحكيم. وبعد. Lesson number 5 of أثر الحديث الشريف. Today's lesson is going to be quite, inshallah, detailed and intensive. Very important aspects to be discussed. And actually the main, I mean, everything was important before this as well, but the actual, you know, intense part of the book starts from here. I started off this aspect. We just briefly started off this chapter. As-sababu al-awwal fi bayani mata yasluhu al-hadithu al-sharifu lil-amali bih. If you have those notes that I gave, which is a summary of... you know, the book, reasons for disagreement amongst the Imams, and we've started the first reason. The first reason, when does a hadith qualify to be acted upon? So this is the first reason we're looking at, and then he's divided this first reason into A, B, C, and D. Okay, so there's four aspects to this first reason. Okay, this first reason. There's A. We're just going to look at A today. Okay, the first point. So what's this whole cause or reason? What's the heading again? The first reason. What was the heading? What did they say there again? Reason for? The first reason. When does a hadith qualify to be acted upon? So, as we know, listen to this carefully. You'll have to listen more than read the book, because the book will be very confusing today. As you know, the differences of opinion between imams, and we're looking at fiqh issues. Yeah, different imams say different things, different madhabs have different opinions about praying, about fasting, and all the different... Most of it is to do with the hadith. And this is why this whole book is about how hadith influences differences of opinion. So then the question is that when does a hadith qualify to be acted upon? So if it qualifies to be acted upon, then you act upon it. And if it disqualifies to be acted upon, meaning it does not qualify to be acted upon, then you don't act upon it. So when is it fit enough? So the word is yasluh. It's from the word salah. Salah is opposite of fasad in Arabic. You know, they say salih, which means pious, but it actually means, saluha means something correct and good and appropriate. That's what saluha yasluhu means. And opposite of that is fasad, which is like corrupted, bad. So if you say an apple is good, you'll say salah, it's a good apple. Buduwu salahiha. There's a whole chapter in hadith that buying and selling of fruits. قَبْلَ بُدُوِّ صَلَاحِهَا. قَبْلَ بُدُوِّ صَلَاحِهَا, meaning before it's ripe. And after it's ripe, بَعْدَ بُدُوِّ صَلَاحِهَا. So the salah is that the apple has ripe, the fruit has ripe, the date has ripe, etc. So the word here used is salah. Okay, I'm just trying to ease the discussion so that you can understand it perfectly. It's very important to understand this perfectly. We've just started 2-3 minutes ago, but I'm just setting the scene, because really this is a very deep and detailed discussion today. It's probably one of the most important lessons. So, hadith, the disagreements occur because of hadith. So the title is, when does a hadith sharif, a noble hadith, qualify? When is it fit? When is it right? When is the hadith good enough to be acted upon? And when you don't act upon hadith. So there's a difference of opinion between the Imams about this. And then he said that this first cause or reason will look at will be divided into four different points. And that's why in the handouts I've made it into A, B, C, and D. And he mentioned last week we read that these four. So let's look at, without looking at all, going back, we'll get to each one, A, B, C, D. So A, the first point under this heading, when does the hadith qualify to be acted upon? Under that heading, A, the first point, he says, أَمَّا النُّقْطَةُ الْأُولَى فَسَأَعْرِضُ لَهَا بِإِخْتِصَارٍ كَيْ لَا أُبْعِدَ عَنِ الْمَوْضُوعِ كَثِيرًا. As far as the first point is concerned, A, I will present it in brief. Even he's saying it in brief, but it's not really in brief. Well, relatively it's brief to if you look at other aspects. So that, he says, so that I don't go far away from the topic too much. I don't, you know, divert from the topic too much. So it will be, it won't be in too much detail. So the A, he actually, the heading of the A was Al-Ikhtilafu fi ba'di shuruti siha, the difference of opinion in some of the conditions of hadith authenticity. So that's the A point. Now, this first point is about, see, when we say a hadith qualifies to be acted upon, yeah, it's fit enough. So one of the basic things that is done when you say a hadith is fit enough or good enough or qualifies or does not qualify, one of the first things, there's lots of things you have to look at for qualification. There's lots of aspects and angles involved. Hadith qualification. Yeah, like one thing, is it opposing the Quran or not? Or this, is it opposing another hadith? All that will come afterwards. When there's a hadith in Bukhari, Muslim, Tirmidhi, Nasai, Abu Dawud, anywhere, does this hadith qualify to be used as evidence, to be acted upon? Can you apply this in your salah and now say, okay, this is how you pray salah, or this is the rule for this? Lots of things are involved. Yeah, lots of things are involved. Does it contradict another one, another more authentic hadith or not? Or does it contradict the Quran? All of that will come afterwards. But the first basic thing you do is that, is this hadith in itself authentic or not? That's the first thing. So therefore, the first point is about authentication. You know, we hear the word sahih. Okay? So the first basic criteria is what? The first point, does a hadith qualify? I'm repeating, I know myself, just to put this in our minds and heads. Is a hadith fit enough to be acted upon? The first A point, the first check on the checklist, the first thing you do is look, is it sahih? Okay? Now, he will tell us here that, I'll read the Arabic, and then I'll have to explain this to you in detail. اتفق جمهور العلماء على أن شروط الحديث الصحيح خمسة وهي اتصال السند وثبوت عدالة الراوي وثبوت ضبطه وسلامة السند والمتن من الشذوذ وسلامتهما أيضا من العلة القادحة. He's giving us the definition. What is a hadith sahih definition? Okay, this, I've been teaching this like this. Even in the morning, I'm actually teaching. Right now, we're going through the definition of sahih for the past 3 days. Friday, I started slowly, like one line in 40 minutes lesson. Basic mistake sometimes people make is when they look at the word sahih, especially some people who are accustomed to Asian subcontinent languages, so Urdu, Gujarati, I don't know, Bengali, maybe do they use the word sahih in Bengali as well? Because we have the word sahih in Urdu, Gujarati, Punjabi, Bengali, we have this word sahih. Sahih means correct, good. So suddenly, is this hadith good? Is it correct? Is it fine? And opposite of that is like ghalat or bad or corrupt. It's completely misunderstanding. This word sahih is an Arabic technical term. In linguistically, sahih means somebody who's healthy is called sahih as well. Opposite of marid. Linguistically, but here it's not the linguistic meaning. In hadith definition, there is a specific definition given to a hadith sahih. There's a specific definition given. Okay? Now, before understanding this definition, In the time of the Messenger sallallahu alayhi wasallam, there was no such a thing called hadith sahih. There was no definition. There's nowhere in the Quran, a surah, an ayah in the Quran telling us that this is the definition of a sahih hadith. Okay? Of course not. There's no hadith telling us what a hadith sahih is. In the time of Sahaba, there was no such a thing as sahih, or the second is called hasan. Hasan and sahih are both like, hasan is a lower level of sahih, but it's still like, it's sound, basically you can use it as evidence. And then you have da'if, which is weak, or and then you have mawdu, fabricated. But in the time of Sahaba, there was no such a thing as sahih. In the time of Tabi'un as well, there wasn't really, maybe some beginning parts, but there wasn't really, there was no such a thing as sahih. Because look, in the time of the Messenger sallallahu alayhi wasallam, because remember, this sahih is not, a'udhu billah, this is not defining what the Messenger sallallahu alayhi wasallam said. We're not saying, oh, what he said is sahih, or what he said was, but that's actually quite disrespectful. This, it's not like saying, oh, this hadith, the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wasallam said, this is sahih. We're not judging what he said. We're judging whether he said it or not. Do you understand the point? We're judging whether, we're trying to ascertain whether he said this or not. This sahih is for the chain, not for the text. So in the time of the Messenger sallallahu alayhi wasallam, he said something, the sahaba won't ask him, is it sahih? He's the one who's saying it, you're hearing it with your ears. In the time of Tabi'un as well, there was no such a thing, because imagine you're sitting in the dars and majlis of Abdullah ibn Mas'ud, and he says, I heard the Messenger sallallahu alayhi wasallam say this. There's no question of sahih, because he is a sahabi, you're sitting with him, and he's heard the Messenger sallallahu alayhi wasallam. You don't need anything else. In the later generation, tabi'een again. Imagine you're sitting in the gathering and the dars of Hassan al-Basri. He says, I heard Sayyiduna Ali ibn Abi Talib said that the Messenger sallallahu alayhi wa sallam said this. No problem, because you know Hassan al-Basri. That's why you're sitting, you respect him, you trust him. And he's saying, Ali radiallahu anhu, who's a sahabi, of no question. And he says, the Messenger sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, there's no such thing. Even in the latter generation, it was like somebody who you knew is relating from a major tabi'i. So still, there's no question. But then as time passed, when books, literally in the, this started around the 3rd century, Imam Bukhari's time, more so. There was early, you know, bit of qawa'id and principles in the beginning, but remember, so Imam Abu Hanifa and all these guys were, even before the term hadith sahih came into existence. Do you understand this point? But, so it started later in the 3rd generation, because now somebody is telling you a hadith, brother, come here. I heard from someone who heard from someone who heard from this tabi'i, who heard from the sahabi, who heard from the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, that he said this. Who is this someone who heard from someone? Tell me his name. Who is he? What is it? Could that someone be just telling porcupines? You know, could he be lying? Could he be making it up? Could that someone, could he be some munafiq, some hypocrite just trying to, you know, come into the midst of the Muslims and fabricate the religion? Who is it? Now, in the 3rd, 4th century, this whole thing started up. So then the ulama sat down and said, look, we can't trust anyone who says, like, anyone could just stand up and say, oh, I heard from this person, could just make up, fabricate names. I heard from Fulan bin Fulan, from Abdullah bin Yusuf, from Muhammad bin Ibrahim, from, you know, just give some fancy names, and who are these guys? What's going on? So then they started writing books and putting in a system in place. That there needs to be a criteria based on which you have to judge whether a hadith is actually something that the Messenger sallallahu alaihi wasallam did say or did not say. And that's when these terms came up. So the criteria was made by the ulama muhaddithin. More or less general broad criteria is agreed upon, but within the definition, there's differences as well. Do you understand? Because this, the criteria is not fully agreed upon, and this is what he's going to try to explain. Generally, the definition is agreed upon. But within this general definition, there are differences as well of different imams and different muhaddithin and fuqaha. Do you understand this basic point? So when we're looking at hadith, when does it qualify to be acted upon? The first check is whether it's authentic or not. And then what is an authentic hadith? Okay? Also, when we the term sahih has this definition, which I'm going to explain to you right now. But before I do that again, the way we translate the word sahih, how do you translate it? Say authentic. People say that. Yes, a lot of people will say that. But I personally just don't like. I like a better. Anything else? You know, I think most of the words will be similar, synonyms to authentic. But the point, which is very important, is not authentic, but authenticated. It's a very big difference. That's why I strongly put emphasis on this. Sahih literally means authentic. But in Arabic, it's in the meaning of... This which is very important to keep in mind. This came again recently. In Arabic, we should keep this in mind. It's in the meaning of musahhah. You know, in Arabic, you have sahih means authentic. Musahhah means authenticated. You see, the word sahha yasihu means to be authentic in of yourself. Sahha yusahihu, somebody else is authenticating. Why am I making a big deal out of, why not sahih? It is called sahih, but the meaning is really musahha. Why? Because this is a point that a hadith which is sahih is not independently authentic, like Allah didn't make something sahih. It's not like it's already sahih and people just identify it, or you know. It is considered to be sahih. It is classed to be sahih. It is categorized to be sahih. It is deemed to be sahih. It is judged as sahih by who? By human beings. By muhaddith, good human beings, of course. But it is judged and considered and classified and categorized and deemed by someone. It's not in itself sahih. Do you understand this point? Very important point. That's why I normally say, you know, you have in Arabic mudaf and mudaf ilayh. Yeah, what do you say mudaf and mudaf ilayh in English? You have something like kitabu zaydin, the book of Zayd, you know.
Possession.
Owner and ownership. Yeah, okay, kitabu zaydin or babu baytin, the door of the house. So the word sahih, I normally say this, I haven't read this anywhere, but I normally say this, the word sahih is mudaf. It has to be attributed to something. When someone says this hadith sahih, the next question is, according to whom? It's not independently sahih. It's according to whom? Someone is classifying it as sahih. This is a very important point. It's not independently sahih. It's judged as sahih. It's classed as sahih. It's deemed to be sahih. That's why the word musahhah means deemed to be sahih. That's why I normally translate as authenticated, or we say rigorously, because there's been rigorous check that's taken place. Rigorously authenticated by somebody. Okay, these are very important points to keep in mind. Lots of questions and things are answered by this. I'll give you a classic example of this, and I think I mentioned this maybe in Aqidah last year or the year before. I must have mentioned it. I was once reading a book, just this an example to tell you this difference. I was reading once a book, I can't remember now, there was a book, I can't even remember exactly what book, I completely forgot what the book was about, but anyway, the footnote, etc., was by some contemporary student of knowledge, or someone from Saudi or somewhere, I can't remember. Now, in the original text of the book, there was a discussion about some issue. And the author, maybe it was original classical author, was saying that this is an opinion of such and such imam. I think he said Imam Abu Hanifa. This is وَأَخَذَ بِهِ أَبُو حَنِيفَ. This opinion has taken by Abu Hanifa. If I remember correctly, Imam Abu Hanifa or Shafi'i, I don't remember who, but maybe I think it was Imam Abu Hanifa. And he said, and he used as evidence the following hadith. And then he put the hadith. Yeah, that's in the... He used as wastadalla bihadha al-hadith. He used as evidence the following hadith. On that, when he used the following as a hadith, there's a number one, yeah, footnote. You look down on the footnote, the one who's editing and annotating the book, he puts number one and he says at the bottom, this is a contemporary, some student or some scholar, you know, contemporary guy. He puts number one, and what does he say? That lakin, however, in Abu Hanifa, using this hadith as a proof for his opinion, fihi nazar, like this is problematic. Why? Because this hadith is da'if. Okay? Why is it da'if? He gave the dalil that this hadith is da'if because fi sanadihi, in the chain, there's this rawi, and this rawi is da'if, as explained by, if you want, Sheikh Albani in his book, such and such, checks Albani, volume this, reference this, Albani, basically, hadith considered, he said, da'afahu al-Albani, the hadith is da'if, because Albani has considered it to be da'if. Okay, I don't know if you remember this, if I said this. Now, for a normal, average onlooker reader, how does that sound as? That sounds like, that. Okay, there was a hadith, which independently Allah and His Messenger made da'if, but Abu Hanifa, despite being a nice person, made a mistake, and for on this occasion, in this issue, what did he do? He by mistake used the da'if hadith, and we're just highlighting that. Sorry, you know, Albani is highlighting that, look, there's a hadith which Allah in Quran, in Surah Al-Baqarah, said was da'if, and Albani just is telling you that it's da'if. That, sorry, Abu Hanifa made a mistake. That's how it sounds like, isn't it? But that exactly is not, if I say it in a different way, it's as follows. What that sounded like, but you know what, that is in reality. In reality is, you could have written it in this way. There is a hadith, there's an opinion. Imam Abu Hanifa says this. However, Imam Abu Hanifa uses a hadith which he thinks is sahih. However, there's another opinion of another imam who thinks is da'if. So, basically there's a hadith, two people are disagreeing about this hadith. Imam Abu Hanifa, if he's using it, then he thinks it's sahih, that's why he's using it. Imam Abu Hanifa thinks this hadith is sahih, who lived in the 2nd century, and he thought in his time, before even the hadith sahih came into, like a definition came into existence, he probably heard it from one person who heard from a sahabi, and he is of the opinion the hadith is sahih. However, somebody living 1400 years after him, with all due respect to him, Sheikh Al-Imam Al-Bani, rahimahullah, his opinion, his research is that hadith is da'if. No problem. We're not saying one of them is bad. Both of them are good. But, O reader, take your pick. You follow Abu Hanifa's opinion that is sahih, or Abu Albani's opinion that is da'if. That's it. That's what that is. It wasn't, you remember how it showed as though Abu Hanifa took a da'if hadith which was made independently. Like, do you understand what I'm trying to say? A lot of people misunderstand this. A lot of people think that there is actually, you know, once I remember somebody on Facebook or somebody messaged me, I don't know, some, can I ask you what a mufti is? I said, why do you know that? I said, it's a lengthy, if like people, you know, study and this and that, and this is like a specialization fiqh. So then the person came back and put a message. Is it like, you know, you go and do a proper course where you go and learn all the hadith which are sahih and all the one which are weak? Basically, for some people, deen is all about, just about, it's so simple. It's like when you want to become a scholar, you go and there's like 5 volumes and you just go and go through a list and just memorize all the sahih, these are all sahih, and you go and memorize all these a week and now you become a mufti. That's, you've identified 500 hadiths, you've memorized them, you've gone and learned which ones are sahih and gone and learned which ones are da'if. Now you become a great sheikh. That's how the mentality of people is. It's not just about that. Do you understand what I'm saying? So, a lot of times people say, oh, this hadith is da'if. It seems as though independently there must be a box somewhere where you go and find out where all the sahih hadiths are there, and there's another box where there are da'if. This whole sahih da'if is all about difference of opinion. It's all about personal judgment. You could say, this hadith, there's a hadith sitting here. You could say, this one is sahih. You could say, this one is da'if. You have your proofs, you have your proofs. So there's a difference of opinion between imams in whether a hadith is sahih or not as well. It's not in itself. Allah didn't make something sahih. The Messenger sallallahu alaihi wasallam did not say this hadith is sahih. Do you understand my point? That's why I like to use the word musahha. It's considered by somebody. So whenever there's a hadith sahih, then the question is, according to whom? This hadith is sahih. Who said? Whose opinion? Someone's opinion that it's sahih. You know, Sahih al-Bukhari has all sahih hadiths. Why? Because his opinion is that it's sahih. But then, yes, the rest of the ummah agreed with him that we agree with you, O Bukhari, that whatever you thought is sahih, we also agree that it's sahih. But in the beginning, there were some people who disagreed. Actually, there was one imam, Imam Daraqutni, he disagreed with handful, like good 15-20 hadiths of Bukhari, he said they were da'if, according to his opinion. But then later imams then refuted that, and then there's ijma', complete agreement of the ummah, that all the hadiths of Bukhari are authenticated. But Imam Dharqutni, major muhaddith, he wrote a whole book that there's so many hadiths of Bukhari which, according to my opinion, are not sahih. Do you understand what I'm saying? So I'm just starting off, like, this is just an introduction. There's lots more to say. So this word, going back to what we were saying, that when does a hadith qualify to be acted upon? There's lots of things to look at. First thing is it authenticated, authentic or not? Then the word authentic, sahih, I told you there's a linguistic meaning, but there's a technical definition that's coming. But before I mentioned the technical definition, we have to understand that this technical definition is a definition that was made by people in the third, fourth generation. Later on, actually, properly, it was really in the 4th, 5th century. It started off in the 3rd century. Remember, I told you in the beginning, there was no need for it. Because, you know, someone here heard from the Tabi'i, you heard from the Sahabi, so there was no need. But later on, there became more of a need. And the seeds of this classification, categorization of hadith were laid or planted in about the 3rd generation. Third century. This is when Imam Bukhari, Imam Tirmidhi, this is the first time people started using the terms. Third century, Imam Abu Hanifa has gone to his Lord when even the term Sahih came. Imam Malik's gone to his Lord as well before the term Sahih came. Imam Tirmidhi and these guys were the first people. And then after that, properly, because in the 3rd century, they were still finalizing, you know, Sahih al-Bukhari, Muslim, the proper books were coming to existence. Then after that, actually in the 4th century, when this science of classification got into, you know, 5th gear, basically, properly. And then 5th century, it was properly, books were starting being written, 6th century, 7th century. Actually, it carried on, you know, it wasn't still fully established, the science, until about 8th, 9th century, because Ibn Salah was in the 7th century, 6th century. Who was one of the main pioneers in this, and then after that Imam Nawawi. So around 7th, 8th century, fully firmly established this science. So, we learn the word sahih is in the meaning of musahhah, which means what? What's the translation? Authenticated, rigorously authenticated. That's why you'll see the word rigor in that book, because I've changed that in the editing. In a rigorously authenticated hadith. Rigorously authenticated. I remember the translator put authentic and I changed it to authenticated. So it's an authenticated hadith. Okay, rigorously authenticated. Now, what is that rigorously authenticated hadith? He's mentioned here that, look, the mainstream majority of the scholars have said that a hadith sahih, which is authenticated, has 5 conditions. So basically, there are 5 conditions for hadith sahih. Like I told you, this is a book, there's about 6-7 pages on it to look at it in detail. I'll just explain to you. These are the 5 conditions. These were all made by muhaddithin, and, you know, scholars made these conditions. Who made these conditions? Scholars. Later on, just to sort of, these conditions were made. Who made these conditions? Scholars, yeah. I'm repeating this because, you know, a lot of young people, they think sahih is like something that Allah's Messenger made, sallallahu alaihi wasallam. Human being, man made it. I'll give you a small, just anecdotal story about this. You know, there was this great, I think I might have mentioned this before, I've said it in a few talks. There was this great scholar from the subcontinent. He's passed away now, rahimahullah. We were privileged to receive hadith ijazah from him. He passed away in 1997. He was about 94 years old or something like that, in 1997. So he lived from 1900 and something. Really old scholar. He's been to England, he's been to Leicester as well. His name was Mufti Mahmud al-Hassan Gangohi, rahimahullah. He's got his fatawa in 20 volumes. He was a grand mufti of Darul Deoband and a hadith scholar, a major, major scholar. He came in 1996 to England. He stayed for 2 weeks. He could hardly hear, walk, speak, and he was in his old old age. And one year after that, he passed away in South Africa. There's lots of his students, some people are still alive. And we remember we completed our Sahih al-Bukhari with him and all the books, and he gave us Hadith Ijaz. It was very high asanid. But before that, he came in around 1987. He actually stayed 3 days at my father's house, stayed 3 days here in 1987. I still remember, I was quite young. He stayed 3 days, he slept, and he stayed here. A very, very famous scholar. He's like world-renowned. He's passed away in South Africa. There's a written about him. He was very talented, very knowledgeable, hadith, fiqh. Like I said, 40 years he was a Grand Mufti of India. 40 years, like a major and hadith scholar. I'll show you this fatawa, Mahmudiyya, like 20 thick volumes. And he's reached hadith and fiqh, a real top scholar. But at the same time, he was very witty. You know, there's so many things about him, like some amazing things, like very witty in his answers as well. So, I remember I told, anyway, there's another, that story has come to mind, but let's leave it. But this one, the one that relevant, once he was, he went for Umrah, and he was sitting in the Haram, Mecca or Medina or somebody, somewhere. And a student of knowledge from, I think, Medina University or somebody, they found out that this, one of the great scholars of India has come. And, like, he was well renowned. So one or two of them, they said, let's go on. Let's talk to him. You know, this guy is a faqih Hanafi, the mufti of the Hanafis, or a big scholar from subcontinent. So they came and sat down and sat. This is written in the books. I read this. So one of them said that, look, after meeting, said, we want to have a discussion with you. We want to debate you. Akhi, we want to debate you. What's the debate? We want to debate you about one of the fiqh issues, like, why do you guys, don't raise your hands in prayer? You know, the raf'ul yadain. I mean, that in itself is not a big issue anyway. It's just the difference of issue is actually what's preferable. According to the Hanafis, it's perfectly fine. Yeah? A lot of Hanafis forget that it's absolutely, totally permissible, no problem whatsoever to do Raf'u Yadayn. Sometimes it's good to do it as well, at least act upon, because there's two types of narrations. Now and then, the odd occasion, a Hanafi should do that, just to sort of at least act upon. Sometimes Hanafis never acted upon that hadith. I do a lot of times. What I do is whenever I go where there's lots of people are doing it, then I'll do it there. Mm-hmm. Just two. It's good. I make two intentions, because we're acting upon the hadith, and also, ta'alif anil qulub, like molding in and, with the people. That's a good intention. As long as you don't start then, doing haram things. Let me also, do some haram thing. I'm just going to do a party as well, because... No, within limit, this is one of the sunnahs of the, actually the Sahaba and even the Prophet ﷺ, this is from the sunnah. The Imam Bukhari mentioned this, and the Prophet ﷺ, he said to Aisha radiallahu anha, I'm going off topic, but he said to Aisha radiallahu anha once that, the Kaaba, he said, I wanted this Kaaba, the Hatim, the Hatim around the Kaaba, that's inside, the Kaaba. He said, my intention is to really, rebuild the Kaaba. It's been built and rebuilt many times, but he said, I want to what? I really feel the desire to build it again, and bring the Hatim into the Kaaba, and make two doors: one door for people to enter, another door for people to exit. But I'm not doing that. Lola hadithu qawmu ahdin bil jahiliya. Lola qawmuka hadithu ahdin bil jahiliya. Had your people, meaning your tribe, Quraysh, not been so close to Jahiliyyah, I would have done it. Meaning, I don't want to do this, something which is recommended, and they just cause commotion. I leave the commotion, and let the non-recommended, less preferable, to carry on, no problem. This is such an important issue where lots of people, of imams and knowledgeable people, don't act upon it. Like, there's something, okay, makruh, or slightly better not to do, but if you're trying to change that, in your community, it's just going to cause friction and commotion. So the sunnah is, leave it. Yeah, if someone's doing haram or something, like you become an imam. This one guy recently graduated from a madrasa, 22 years old. His blood is boiling. He's still not married. Okay? He suddenly just graduated from a madrasa, and he's gone there, and there's been something happening for 600 years in that masjid. And suddenly he comes like some... 22-year-old lad, he just graduated and is boiling. I'm going to change the world in one night. And next day he's like, Jum'ah khutbah. He's like, what are these people? You guys all jahil doing this and this old bid'ah and this and that and these things happening. What's happening? What is it? P45, straight after Jum'ah, gone. Like, there's a hikmah to do it. There's lots of young people don't realize that. There's wisdom to do it. Especially if something's just about preferable, If there's difference of opinion and if it's going to cause commotion in the community, then there's different ways to do it. Like, for example, some people think dua after fard salah is a bid'ah, not bid'ah. It's flexible. You could have two opinions, but even if you have an opinion that you shouldn't do it with the congregation, I personally don't like the whole congregation thing. But something's happening for many, many years. You don't just suddenly like try to change it in one go, etc. You could try to say, maybe, look, this is better, or this, slowly, slowly. So this is what the Messenger sallallahu alayhi wa sallam said. And this is from there, actually Imam Ibn Taymiyyah rahimahullah mentions this, that from this hadith we realize that sometimes to do the less mustahab in order to keep the unity is better. To keep ta'leefan lil qulub, to bring hearts together. Bringing hearts together is fard. And to do something makruh tanzihi for that, that's less of an action. Or you're not doing a mustahab. Yeah, if there's something fard, then you don't leave a fard to bring hearts together. And you don't commit a haram to bring hearts together. But other than that, like if you leave a mustahab out, so like for example, according to the Hanafis, raising hands in prayer is less preferable. But if you're going to do it, that means you're doing slightly less preferable. But if you think everyone's there and you know everyone's doing it and you just want to bring hearts together and you do it for that reason, then you get double reward, no problem. Anyway, I don't want to go off topic because there's so much things to mention. The point I was saying that this person came to that Mufti Mahmud al-Hasan Gangohi, rahimahullah, and he said, look, I want to debate with you about Raful Yadin, raising hands, etc. He said, look, I don't debate, etc. But look, if you want to discuss it, you know, I'm here, inshallah. If you want to ask any questions, no problem. So he said, yeah, okay, let's discuss. It's a very relevant story, anecdote, that's why I'm mentioning it. So that student or that scholar, he said, yeah, okay, no problem. I want to discuss with you about this raising hands. I think it was raising hands or something like the Hanafis, like or reading behind the Imam, you know, contentious issue. But I want to have a debate with you, but I have a condition. He said, what's that condition? He said, I have a condition that when you discuss this issue with me, I think I might have mentioned this in Aqidah, when you discuss this issue with me, then as proof, as evidence, my condition is that I don't want you to say this Imam said this and that Imam said this, and don't bring kalamur rijal. I don't bring the statements of human beings, people, men. I want statements either Quran or Hadith Sahih. That's it. As evidence, I only want Quran and Sunnah, akhi. So I want Quran as proof. Like when you, do you understand what's happening? Yeah. When we're discussing, bring only as evidence what? Like you tell me this is the ayah of the Quran or this is a Hadith. The Messenger sallallahu alaihi wasallam said this. Only then I'll accept. If you say, oh, this Tabi'i says this, that you should do this, then I'm not going to take that as evidence. So the Sheikh said, okay, agreed. I agree with your condition. No problem whatsoever. But before we carry on, tell me what's the definition of Sahih Hadith. You said you only want, he actually said, I only want what? My condition is either Quranic verse or Sahih Hadith. So he says, tell me what a Sahih Hadith is. He said, every student knows what a Sahih Hadith, what we're going to read just now, the five conditions. He says, basic, who doesn't know Sahih Hadith? You're trying to test me? He said, no, I'm not trying to test you. I'm just, so that we're on the same wavelength, my understanding, your understanding is the same, just tell me a definition of Sahih Hadith. He said, okay, all right, okay, you know, which is in every basic, you know, the five conditions we're going to read today, like normal, every student reads it. So he starts saying, oh, Hadith Sahih, the first condition is, you know, ittasal sanad, continuation of the chain, and then adalat al-rawi. As he was counting the conditions, he said, wait, stop, before you carry on. Sorry, I forgot, I have a condition as well. You had a condition, I accepted your condition. And my condition is exactly like your condition. So I'm not going to ask you anything more difficult. Whenever, whatever you say, including this definition of Hadith Sahih, I will not accept from you except a verse of the Quran or a Hadith Sahih. Understood? I will not accept from you except what? Don't bring like statements of human beings and tabi'een and this and that. Bring me whatever you're going to say, Quran or Hadith Sahih. He said, okay. So, then he carried on. Sahih. But he said, wait, I just told you, Quran or Hadith Sahih. You're giving me a definition. Which Sahih Hadith is this definition in? Who made this Sahih Hadith definition? You just told me, don't tell me the statements of men. You're telling me the basic criteria, definition of Sahih Hadith according to the statements of men. You just said, don't tell me Kalam Rijal. Your definition, these five conditions were made by men. Not even the Sahaba made it, not even the Tabi. I might use a Sahabi You're not even using the Sahaba, you're not even using the Tabi'un, you're using like maybe some fifth generation people. So why are you using their definition of Sahih Hadith? I thought you hated all these other people in the fourth and fifth generation. Your whole criteria, your definition of Sahih Hadith is based on human beings that lived in the fourth century. So the guy got confused and amused and said, what's going on? Yeah. And he just ended the matter. He goes, he just ended. Because if you're saying that, if you're so eager that I want only Quran, Hadith, Sahih, then give me the definition of Sahih Hadith based on the definition of it based on a Hadith Sahih. Do you understand this whole point? Hadith Sahih, the definition is made by men, great men. I use the word men. I don't like to be, because in Arabic they say Rijal. But these are like, of course, Muhaddithin. You know, we're not trying to undermine them. We're just trying to relatively mention that it's not made by Allah and His Messenger. But these people who made it, of course, they made it. They were great men, like great Muhaddithin. And of course, well accepted. But just relatively, when we say men as opposed to the God, as opposed to the leader of men, Allah and His Messenger, sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. That's why we say men, because even Allah's Messenger, sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, he was a man, but he wasn't like other men, you know. Muhammadun basharun wa laysa kal bashar. We don't want to go into aqidah discussion. He was a bashar, but not like other bashar. He was, the rest were like stones and he was a ruby. So, relatively, we're talking about that. So anyway, what is the definition of a sahih hadith? He says here, there's five conditions. First is called ittisal as-sanad. What's the translation in your book? I don't think you have it here, because this, it has, even in the foot, even if you have this, is enough. I know everyone's got a book. First one is continuity of the chain of transmission. What is it? Continuity of the chain of transmission. First condition for a sahih hadith is, in Arabic you say ittisal as-sanad. Okay? Ittisal as-sanad. When they are checking whether hadith is sahih, remember these are five conditions made by men, great men, muhaddithun. The first condition they put in, it's got, you can say, five conditions or five characteristics or five attributes of a hadith sahih. Continuation of the chain, sanad, ittisal sanad. What that means is basically, when they investigated the chain, they would need to prove that every person mentioned next to the, you know, every person that's, or every narrator that's been mentioned in the chain, has definitely heard or received, not heard necessarily, because sometimes it's not hearing, sometimes written format they give it. That's why they use talaqqa. Has necessarily, definitely received this hadith from the person above him. There's no disconnection. Okay? So you have a chain in which there's eight people. Yeah? There's the author of the book, Imam at-Tirmidhi, for example. He says, I heard from my teacher, who heard from this narrator, who heard from this tabi'i, who heard from this sahabi, who heard from the Messenger sallallahu alaihi wasallam that he said. Now, this is what they would rigorously check. Imagine there's one person saying, I heard from this person, but the one he heard from died 10 years before this person was born. So there's something fishy and dodgy here. The sheikh who he's saying he's heard from died in 433 century, and this one was born in 453 Hijri, 20 years after him. Or the one he's narrating from lived in Kufa, and he lived in Baghdad. He never left Baghdad, and he never left Kufa. So where did they meet? In dreamland? No, that's not possible. And even if they did, then that's not, you know, accepted, it's not valid. You have to meet in real life, not dream life. A lot of people build their whole life on dreams, which is another topic altogether. People are too obsessed about dreams in this day and age. Too obsessed. Anyway, so this is ittisal sanad, continuation of chain. Have you understood what ittisal sanad means? Ittisal sanad means what? Every narrator has received and obtained and gained this hadith from the narrator before, And this happens from the beginning of the chain to the end of the chain. Min awwal sanad ila muntaha. This is the meaning of continuation of the chain. The opposite of continuation is of the chain is what? Disconnection. Disconnection will make this hadith to be non-sahih, non-authenticated. You know, because if it's like disconnection, so the, some sort of disconnection. So anyway, this is the first condition. Second condition, they say in Arabic, adalatul rawi. Adalatul rawi. Establishing, if you see here in your notes, establishing the uprightness of the narrator. Yeah, no, that's fine. Okay, yeah, I was just looking at the time as well. It's okay, keep it like this. Establishing the adalatul rawi. Now the word adala, some people have names, adil. Yeah, adil means just. But we don't use the word just because just is very specific. In Arabic, the word adala is very comprehensive, and especially here, you know, adala means uprightness. Adil means an upright. Morally, ethically, Islamically, the person's good. Okay? Now there's lengthy discussion that's gonna come, who is an upright and who considers somebody to be upright. But the second thing they would check, first once they've firmly established that every person has received the hadith, there's a connection, then the second screening would be to check each individual narrator. You start from the Sahabi, no problem, you don't even need to go there. As Sahaba too, that's why they say kulluhum adul. They are all upright, unless if you're some hardcore from the Shia community, then you might have a problem with that, but that's another story. But generally they say all the Sahaba are what? Upright, so no problem. You start from the Tabi'un. Now, who is this Tabi'i? Generally, you don't have to do too much investigation because most Tabi'in, most, not all, yeah, are Adil. Hajjaj bin Yusuf was technically a Tabi'i. But he was a Dalim. So, you know, it's not like all the Tabi'ins are upright completely. There are some corrupted ones as well. Tabi'in is just a follower, somebody who saw a Sahabi. But generally, so they investigate. And they would investigate thoroughly, like absolutely scrutinize. And that's why then, you know, alongside, I will mention this later on more, but alongside, after these five conditions, alongside this science of what is a sahih, the science of al-asma wal-rijal came into existence. Al-asma wal-rijal. Al-asma means names, rijal means narrators. Meaning, that, because when you're trying to establish each person, then they're biographies were then written in books. This science is called Asma wa Rijal. It's also called Al-Jarhu. Remember these words, very important words. Jarh, Jim Raha, Jarh. And Ta'deel. Ta'deel is from the word Adala. Ta'deel means to consider somebody to be. John, write, write. You could be our writer. I'm not going to write. Yes. Just. Write in Arabic, jarh. Jarh. Al-jarh. Okay? Yeah. Wa al-ta'deel. Yeah, I've got this as well. Sorry for the people online. We just, you might have to miss out on something on the board. It's just, yeah. This is, just use that if you want that cleaning. Yeah. Al-ta'deel. Okay? And just write, adala. Al-adala. This is in Arabic. Can you see? Al-adala. Al-adalatu. Adala means uprightness. And the person who is upright is called adil. And this al-jarh, jarh literally means wounding. You're wounding his what? Reputation. Someone's reputation is wounded. If it's not considered to be, it's like you're critically analyzing. This is an amazing science that came into existence side by side, that some of the non-Muslims, Orientalists, were in awe with this science. There was this guy who lived in the 1970s, I think 1970s, German Orientalist, professor of Islamic studies. What was his name? Dr. something Springer, something like that, Springer. Yeah, he was a very famous Orientalist. He actually made a comment on this science. And he said that the Muslims have this amazing science of al-jarhu wa ta'deel. critically analyzing the reporters. Yeah, jarh means criticizing them. Ta'adil is judging them to be adil. So either you say he's a good person or a bad person. This whole science, Muslims have this unique science. You know what he said? He said, this science is such that no one in history ever has ever in the history of man, no one ever, no community, no nation, no religion, no group has ever been able to bring such a science into existence. And neither until the world ends, anyone I think would be able to bring a science like this. Such that the Muslims have the detailed biography of 500,000 people preserved in the library. And it is for 500,000 people. Every minute detail. Who is this person? Where was he born? Who was the teacher? Who was the student? You know, minute things. Did he used to wear leather socks and wipe on it? Every small thing critically analyzed and taken. Some books, like for example, we have, like, can you see that Sir A'lam al-Nubala? That's a whole 25 volume of Imam Dhahabi. That's biographies. Then you have Taqrib al-Tahdib, you have Tahdib al-Kamal. I have a few, just a few on the science. That's a, you could, it's a massive science with just books on what? Critical analysis, biographies of these, all the hadiths, all the hadith reporters. Yeah, so this is called al-jarhu wa ta'dil. He said what? 500,000. It's like he said, it's like one of the wonders of the world, that today we have the biographies of the minute details. And minute details to what extent is that one of them said, Yahya bin Ma'in or Ali ibn al-Madini or somebody was saying, somebody said, now when we used to go, and these guys are major, like in this field as well, there are like top people, Imam Dhahabi, Ali ibn al-Madini, Yahya bin Ma'in, Yahya bin Sa'id al-Qattan, these guys are like the top people in the science. They dedicated their lives to the science of, which one? Science of al-jarh wa ta'dil, or al-asma wa rijal. That's just the biographies. That came into existence side by side this. Because when you're saying, we're looking at the second condition, remember, we're coming back to the second condition. Every narrator has to be adil. So then the biographies have to be scrutinized. So Yahya bin Ma'in or Ali ibn al-Madini, one of those two said, when we used to go and investigate. Yeah, us guys, when we need to go and buy a car, we'll go in a group and investigate. Or when we go and check. Yeah, HMC used to go and check things. They went to different slaughterhouses. These guys used to, if they find a narrator in a hadith, yeah, where was he living? In Kufa. All right, come on, brothers, let's go. On the horse, on the camel, off to Kufa for a week. Why? Going to investigate such and such a rawi. They stay there 7 days. They stay in the community, locality. They find his brother, if he's alive or not. If he's alive, if he's not alive, his son or grandson. They try to meet the old people, old women in the community. They do a thorough investigation. Who was he? What did he do? Everything about him to try to determine, was this guy a reliable person? Could you rely on him as a narrator of hadith? So Yahya bin Ma'in said that when we used to go and investigate and ask so many detailed questions about these people, some people used to ask us that, why are you investigating about this person so much? Has a proposal come to you for your daughter in marriage from this person, so you're finding you want to know so much about this person? So they used to say that, no, brother, it's more important than that. Al-amru ahammu min dhalik, is more important than the proposal. If our daughter went in the wrong hands, it's possible to get talaq or something. But if deen goes into the wrong hands, then it gets corrupted. It's more important than, they would be more, wary and more careful in investigating than even giving their daughter to somebody. Like, you know, you would find out about somebody, oh, my daughter's going to go to this guy, who is he? You know, double, triple, like they would really investigate. So this is the science of al-asma wal-rijal. Okay? So, what's the second condition? I'm explaining all of this in a lot of detail, yeah? Because this is a very important topic. A lot of things gets understood by all of these things. Then things will become easier. So first one was what? continuation of chain. You understood that? Number two, adalatur rawi al adala, uprightness. Now, what is, they have a definition of uprightness as well. Okay, now the author will tell us a bit more things about it, but to understand that, I have to tell you the definition of adala, because you won't be able to understand what the author is saying. The normal adala is the definition I have here, which I've been, you know, in all the books. Salamatul mukallaf min al fisqi wa khawarim al muru'a. This is not in this book that we're reading. I'm telling you the definition, which is in the books of Usul Hadith. They say that that person, that narrator, the mukallaf, the legally responsible person, if you want to call somebody adil, like this applies to us as well, any Muslim, the legally responsible person, you know, mukallaf, who's the legally responsible person? Puberty, sane, etc., and aqil, baligh, and Muslim. That's given, you know, you have to be adil, you have to be a Muslim, of course. So he's a Muslim, it's a mukallaf, who's a Muslim, who's baligh and who's aqil, yeah, who's reached puberty. They also discuss about whether a child's narrating is accepted or not. There's a bit of difference of opinion about that. The author hasn't mentioned this in the book, but there's a difference of opinion. Some say, look, child, if he's reached the level of discernment, like he can, it's not puberty, but he can distinguish between right and wrong. He knows if you give 50 pence and you get this much change, and you know, then if he narrates a hadith, then it's accepted. Some said no. So there's difference of opinion. That's what the author is, Sheikh Awam is going to, he's trying to explain to us in this point, where we're going to get to, that there's difference of opinion about the finer details about the sahih. These five conditions I'm talking about, they're all agreed upon. Nobody says, oh, there's six conditions, or not this condition. These five, what I'm talking about, that's, everyone agrees on this. But then in application and finer details of these five conditions, there's difference of opinion. Now, when there's difference of opinion, somebody might think a hadith is sahih, and somebody might think the same, because they disagreed in some details of that. This is what he's trying to say. That look, you can't, there's no independent, you can't just say, oh brother, this is sahih hadith, and you didn't act upon it. Well, there's a difference of opinion on what sahih hadith is. This is what he's going to explain. So, the definition of adil, upright, is, what is it? This Muslim who's reached puberty, who's sane, he is someone who is free from fisq, apparent sinful activities. Nobody knows the inner details of anyone, only Allah knows. Yeah, but apparently, he is not a fasiq. So he's not involved in, they say fasiq is somebody who does not commit major sins, and israr ala saghira, he doesn't continuously do minor sins. Okay, so someone who prays, fast, zakat, hajj, he doesn't do ghiba, doesn't do backbiting, doesn't drink alcohol, doesn't, you know, all, like he's a sound Muslim generally, he's not a fasiq. He doesn't commit major sins. So they would investigate. And also, second thing, he's also free from those things that go against basic social etiquette, like things which are blameworthy. So they may not be sinful, khawarimul muru'ah, like, you know, demeaning or disrespectful things. So like, the guy's not a fasik, but he, you know, when he walks in the road, he jumps up and down like crazily. Or he drives a car like a crazy way. Actually, that might be haram, but you know, he's driving a car like a crazy person. They'll say, this guy, you can't take a hadith from him. Because he's not a fasiq, but he's not free from khawarimul muru'ah. Like, how do you translate, how did we translate khawarimul muru'ah? Things that go against
social norms.
Yes. Yeah. Etiquette. You can say social norms. Yeah. So he doesn't do blameworthy things. It might not be sinful. Like, a good example is that in those, and this also, the definition of this, like what is against etiquette, can change from time to time, from place to place. So like, they used to be very careful, like some of them used to be very particular about not walking and eating on the middle of the road. So they, if they saw somebody walking and eating, they would say, okay, this guy doesn't qualify to be a narrator reliable, so his hadith we can't take. Because walking and eating goes against etiquette. You sit down and eat somewhere. Things like that. Or like, you know, his habits, mannerism. Yeah. I mean, this is a lengthy topic. I was talking about this in the morning today, that there's books written on this, you know, that this applies to not just them. I was telling the students today that this applies to all the scholars and students of knowledge. This should apply to that you don't commit major sins and you don't do things which are disrespectful. This should apply to anyone associated with study of deen. So I was telling the students today, and I had for 2 days I've been just talking about this, 2 45-minute lessons, yesterday and today, the same thing we're talking about, Khawarim al-Muru'ah. I told them there's books written on this topic. Imam Nawawi wrote a book, you know, like in his introduction to Al-Majmu', the adab of a scholar, basically, what are the etiquettes of a scholar. And then Mufti Taqi Usmani has a book called Usul al-Iftah wa Adab, which is just behind you, near your head. Underneath that. This is a book in Arabic written by Mufti Taqi Usmani, Usul al-Iftah wa Adabuhu. It's published from Karachi, but it's also published from Damascus, from Jeddah. So in there he's got a whole, it's in Arabic, he's got a whole section, the adab of a scholar about himself, how he should be, a scholar should have his libas should be good, his seerah and his surah should be good, he should stay clean. So like, staying dirty is not haram, but it goes against etiquette. So being filthy, smelly, that goes against, it's khilaful muru'ah. He should have nadafa, tahara, and things like that. Also, his seerah should be good. So, like, he should make his habits, his character, his akhlaq, mannerism in accordance with the sunnah, etc. Number three, he should also make his inner, you know, his niyyah, ikhlas, all of that, and things like that. These are all etiquettes. And lots of things that... that he mentioned about. And I remember when we were studying this book, I remember he mentioned like an example. He said, like, some things are like, you know, like he was saying, I remember this example in class, that he was saying that the other day, you know, there was a commotion near a taxi. One of our students, this was in Pakistan, he was saying there was a commotion. So I was coming and I asked somebody, you know, that there's commotion going on. Two guys are fighting, the taxi driver, and found out that one of the students who's studying to become a mufti is fighting with the taxi driver about 5 rupees. Mufti sahab ka 5 rupees pe jhagra ho gaya. Because that sounds just like a 5 rupees. A good scholar, you should be giving a tip. And this, actually, I talked about this in class today, that this actually is one of the negatives that people have attributed to scholars. In the early times, scholars used to give. The enemy used to run around money and act like beggars. They used to what? They used to give. They used to be, you know, they used to have self-respect. So, not like a freebie. Nowadays, it's like, as a scholar, yeah, make it easy for me because I'm a scholar. So what would you mean? Like, am I some kind of like some loser that, you know, I'm like a beggar? If you're a scholar, you become a beggar. And this is really, really, it's not nice, honestly. And it puts the scholars down. I mean, I don't know if you understand what I'm saying, but this... That's why, you know, I mean, there's a reason behind it as well, because scholars don't get paid, etc. as well. I can understand that as well. There is that. But then there's another counter argument to that as well. If you're a good scholar, you will get paid as well. Yes. I've got a good whole discussion on this. That people say, but yeah, scholars get, you know, peanuts, so they are going to, you know, cry and beg for a bit here and a bit there, and, you know, and they want free things and everything free. Yes, but then I also say that if you're a good scholar, you will get paid. Like anything professional. If you've studied well and you're a good scholar, then you don't have to beg. You can take money respectfully. Not do taweez and take money, and do black magic and take money, and you know, not for dua. Anyone can do dua. You don't have to take hadiya, and you don't have to rely on gifts or duas or taweez or just the sentimental money. No. Offer services properly. Like, you're giving proper service, and this is money, because, like, in every field, and if you're a good scholar, then people will respect those services because it's proper. Anyway, this is I tell these guys a lot about this stuff in class, but anyway, it's not for you guys. What was I talking about? So that was an example he gave, that as a student, as a scholar, it was disrespectful for him to be arguing about 5 rupees. And I says, give him a bit more. Like, why are you arguing about a bit of change? This goes against muru'ah. That's why it's actually recommended for people, students of knowledge, that, you know, if you go somewhere, keep the change. You know, £2 or 20p, like, it's okay, keep the change, no problem. You should do that, like, as you know, I think I mentioned that in class as well before I did. Like, you should do that, like, if, especially if you're with Muslims, you know, like in your community, so they think this guy is of respect. You should do that. Anyway, so the definition of an adil is basically this. What's the definition now? Repeat, go on. Who is an upright? Someone who? Sane, Muslim sane, reached puberty, who stays away from major sins. Yeah, so that's, he's not a fasiq. Fasiq is someone who doesn't do major sins and doesn't continue to do minor sins, and and he's free from blameworthy, you know, things. Yeah, blameworthy things, mean they may not be sinful, but they, you know, distasteful. Okay, like the examples I gave, like jumping up and down, or arguing with that taxi driver, or what? Like, what was the other example I gave? Yeah, remaining dirty clothes and stuff like that. Okay? So this is the definition of basically disgraceful acts and things that, you know, to stay away from things which are considered to be disgraceful or degrading in the community.
What's the Arabic term you used?
For this, yeah. Muru'a. You want to write it? Muru'a. Al-Muru'a. Just write Al-Muru'a. Mimrawa, oh yeah, Hamza and yeah, that's a Hamza and al Muru'a. Muru'a means good etiquette, so not go against that. Self respect, dignity, you know. Number three, as I told you, this is a very lengthy discussion. We're just gonna about to just define a hadith sahih. Number three. But it's important. These things are like really important. I'm really explaining to you like in thorough detail. Yeah? These things are very important. The third condition. So we said so far, continuity of the chain of transmission, establishing the uprightness of the narrator. So everyone's an adil. Adil is upright. Just other conditions. Yeah, it just says other conditions here. Okay, but let me tell you the third definition. Third, because this is like, there's difference of opinion about these conditions. So these are not all the five conditions here in your notes. He's just saying that there are differences about, remember the finer details of these five conditions. So in the first condition, there's a bit, after we understand these five conditions, then we'll go on to see what are the differences in these five conditions. That's why I'm explaining to you first the five conditions, so that then you can understand the slight differences in them. So the third is what we say, dhabt, right? Dhabt. So Adala, just put number one. Yeah, just next to a circle, and just put number two. Yeah, sorry. And then number three, and then right afterwards, just say to Salah Salat. This is al-dabt, yeah, D-A-B-T, or dabt. The translation in there, I think, is not correct in the English translation. What has he said? The translation?
Third one, yeah.
He says here that the scholars have agreed that there's five. Number one, he said, which are? Yeah, this accuracy is a wrong translation. I missed it. The word dhabt does not mean accuracy. See, the translators thought dhabt, you need to do dhabt, you know, proper dhabt of the wording. I missed that. Just keep a note of that. In the next edition, they need to change that. So,
I lost you slightly there.
Adopt. Okay, that's the third condition. Dabt. Dabt basically means preservation. What does it mean? Preservation. So, when they are defining we said continuation, every narrator has heard from somebody else. Yeah, connected. Number two, we checked every single one was what? Every single narrator was who? An adil or an upright person. And we understood what an upright person is. Every one of them has to have this quality of dhabt And the ism fa'il, the doer, like everyone had in the number two, had to have adala, and the one who had adala was called adil. Everyone has to have dabt, and the one who has dabt is called dabit. So every narrator has to be number three, dabit, preserver. Dabt means preservation, masdar. Ism fa'il is called the doer, but there's another technical term as well. The doer, so dabit, preserver. Preserver meaning that this narrator has the firm ability to preserve this narration, either by memory. If it's through memory, then his memory is really good. There's no weakness in his memory. Okay? Or sometimes they used to preserve it by writing. So, for example, if I heard the hadith from the sheikh and I've written it, and then I teach it to the students, from the time I heard it from the sheikh till the time I relate it to my student, in all that time, if I was just doing it through my memory, then my memory was very, very good. There was no weakness in my memory. So they would do this thorough check. That was he very good in his memory? Or if I was doing it by writing, then I was somebody who would keep and preserve my book, and there was no way that I could, you know, raindrops would go into my book and, you know, there'd be smudge and, you know, I would make mistakes. So they would, you know, check this properly. That was, did he have the quality of preservation? Was he a good preserver? Most of them were doing it through memory. So they would check thoroughly the memory. That's why they said sometimes that this narrator is not reliable because his memory is not good. Some of the narrators, they were reliable until a certain age. Until age 57, this guy was reliable. After age 57, he became non-reliable because he started forgetting things, because his memory became weak, etc., etc. So you'll find all these details. This narrator until this age was okay. So if you find him in a hadith, and that hadith was narrated by him under when he was 57, then that hadith was authentic. But if you find him in a hadith and he narrated that hadith after age 57, then this same narrator now has become weak. Hence the hadith has become weak, etc., etc. It's a massive field, this whole thing. This is just absolute basics here, yeah, of this, all this. It's so deep, these issues. Do you understand? So these issues are really, really deep. And we haven't even started the basics properly yet. I'm just giving you like the absolute. Just imagine how much depth of all this knowledge would be. And then somebody just thinks, okay, brother Akhi narrated Abu Huraira, you know, Bukhari and Facebook, mashallah, done. So this is condition number three. Okay? Condition number four is what we say that, so you've checked hadith's continuation, every narrator is upright and every narrator has a quality of preservation. Then you do two negative checks. So these were three positive things. Then you have to do two negative checks. The fourth condition is that this hadith is free from something what they call shudhudh. You know, write shudhudh down. A shudhudh. Isolation. What is it called? Isolation. There's a bit of detailed discussion on this, what is isolation, but basically, you know, it's like, once you've checked these three things, you're basically, you know when you're filling in like something on online, you know, you go to the next page, and you see that, what is it, that bar is like, you're almost there, 40% of your filling in is done, 50, this, it's a bit like that, so it's like 60% you're there. Okay, now just a couple of more checks left. One is that then they will check this hadith, does it have shudud? It has to be free from isolation. Isolation means that this hadith is not opposing another hadith which is narrated by a group of people. There's a bit of detail about it, but a group of people or somebody more authentic. But let's say a group of people. So it's not isolated. So there's one narrator narrating a hadith which goes completely contradictory to what 7-8 narrators are saying about this same hadith, and they've narrated it differently, opposite to this. This one is saying, yes, this is the Prophet ﷺ did it, and those people are saying didn't do it. So this is called isolation. So if it's got this isolation, it's going against, then that means it's not free from isolation, and hence you'll stop there. Okay, this hadith is not sahih. Okay, and then if it's free from isolation, then you're almost there. Yeah, it's actually. This, the final screening is called he has to be free from what we call illah. Let's write it down. Illah al-qadiha. So fifth condition is that it is free from, what is it saying there? From a
serious defect.
Irregularity. Or irregularity or a defect, problematic defect, hidden defect. You know, there's actually books written. You know, each one of these conditions has books written. This final one is so delicate that normally people can't detect it. Like, only the absolute expert muhaddithin. Remember, this was all done in that time. Only they would discover, like, some technical something they found out. It's like a final screen. They checked continuation of chain. They checked all the narrators were upright. They checked they were all really good in their memory. Really good memory. So they're all preserving characteristics they have. There's no isolation as well. Finally, they just put it into the screen. That is just overall check. Is there something like suddenly in the x-ray? It's the final x-ray, basically. This is what illa qadiha means. It's nothing specific. It's like a final x-ray. You put it in the machine. Something's problem. Sometimes they say they don't even know. There's something happening, but they don't know what that problem is. Then they go and investigate. What is that something that is a problem with this? This is why we use the term rigorously authenticated. Because it's gone through five major checks. So, now read that translation. Go and read it. You read it. Read the whole paragraph.
The general body of scholars, Jumhur, agree that there are five conditions for a hadith to be considered rigorously authentic. Continuity of the chain of transmission, establishing the uprightness of the narrator, establishing the accuracy of the narrator.
Yeah, this changed the accuracy to the preservation of the narrator. Yeah. That's actually wrong in translation, yeah.
And soundness of the chain of transmission and text in that they are free from irregularities and from any serious...
Yeah, you said irregularity for shudud. I said isolation for irregularity. You can use irregularity, but better to use isolation. And sound and free from...
any serious defect.
Yeah, any serious defect. This is basically the definition of a hadith sahih. Or it's called the rigorously authenticated hadith. Okay? We're going to end soon. Just to finish off this part. And then we'll go into... next week we'll talk about the differences. Yeah, the author wants to talk about. So I've explained to you the word sahih means considered to be authentic or rigorously authenticated by a definition that was made by scholars. They made these five... everyone agrees these are the five, more or less everybody. These are the five major conditions. And then the author, inshallah, next week, is going to talk about the slight differences in these five conditions, like in the description of these five conditions. And that's where the differences occur. And I also said that it's not independently sahih. Allah didn't, and His Messenger, sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, didn't make something sahih. It's like sahih according to somebody, all of that. And then finally this point, that, you know, when it is said that this such and such hadith, this is a very important point. And this is the final point I'm going to make about this. When it is said that such and such hadith is classed as, or deemed as, or judged as sahih. Yeah, listen to this point carefully. When it is said that such and such hadith is judged as, we should use the word judged as. Or the ulama say its chain is judged. The respect is actually, you know, they say sanaduhu sahih. Because so that it doesn't seem like you're trying to say what the Prophet ﷺ said is sahih or not. So you say this hadith, the chain of this hadith, instead of saying this hadith is sahih, the chain of it is sahih, or the chain of it is weak. Because if you say this hadith is weak, sounds like what the Prophet ﷺ said is weak. So slightly disrespectful, or maybe not slightly, a lot disrespectful. It could come across as disrespectful. So we say this, the chain of this hadith, and I also like to say that don't say the chain of this hadith is sahih, but say the chain of this hadith is classed as sahih. Use that word, or deemed as sahih, or categorized, or considered as sahih. Okay? So when someone says this, that this chain of this hadith is classified, or considered, or categorized, or deemed, or judged, I've used five words, yeah, as sahih. This is the final point. This basically means that technically speaking, based on this criteria and based on these five conditions, this hadith, based on this criteria, based on these five conditions, it is classified as sahih. Listen to this carefully. Classified as sahih. However, in actual fact, the opposite of that, you know, I'll tell you also the definition of da'if hadith, yeah, weak hadith. Weak hadith is basically when one of these five conditions is missing, then that hadith is considered to be a weak narration. You must have heard of the da'if. So basically, sahih hadith, before I come to that point, listen to this again. Sahih hadith is the one where all five conditions are met. If four are met and fifth one is not met, that hadith is classified or deemed as da'if. If the first is not met and the four are met, considered to be da'if. So basically, the definition of da'if is when one of the five condition is not met. If any one or two, then it's definitely da'if. But even if one is not met, okay? So when it is said that such and such hadith is judged as sahih, or such and such is judged as da'if, this only basically means that technically speaking, based on this criteria, this one is, such and such is classified as sahih, and such is deemed as weak. But it does not give you guarantee that 100% in actual fact, the one that is sahih is definitely sahih, and does not give you 100% guarantee in actual fact that the one that's judged and deemed to be weak is definitely weak. Why? Because when we say the one, listen to this carefully, when we say the one that's judged to be sahih, we're saying that based on this criteria, and we should follow this criteria, definitely, but we're saying based on this criteria, okay? Now, based on this criteria, we've said continuation of chain, all the narrators, number two, have been considered to be upright. So there was one narrator upright, but one day he just felt like lying. Possible he could have lied. He was considered to be upright, but he probably just made a mistake, or let's forget the lying one. The third one is possible. One day he forgot. They checked him. They checked his mind. They did a test scan of his brain. He's very good memory, but that one instance, he forgot. So it's possible that in reality, the hadith is not sahih. But technically speaking, opposite, the da'if, when we say a hadith is da'if, yeah, when a hadith is da'if, we've said one condition is missing. Let's say which one's missing? The second one. Second one is what? Uprightness of the narrator. So what happened was that when they were scrutinizing the narrators, they found one guy to be a liar. So they said this hadith is da'if. But you know what? A lying person once in his life might say the truth. The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam said, "Sadaqa wa in kana kadhuban," about shaitan. You know, when shaitan, there was a sahabi, he said he told him to read Ayatul Kursi at night. You know, there's a story. So the Messenger sallallahu alaihi wasallam said about shaitan that this guy's a liar, but today he spoke the truth. So even shaitan can say this. So this guy might be a fasiq, but on this one occasion he just felt like, you know. It doesn't mean that a liar will always lie. So every da'if hadith doesn't necessarily, in actual fact, 100%, it is definitely something that the Prophet ﷺ didn't say. And the one that's sahih doesn't mean without a doubt he did say it. Yes, the one that's sahih, most probably, 90% most probably he did say it. The one that's judged as da'if, most probably 90% he didn't say it. But in the sahih, there's a possibility that he did not say it. In the da'if, there's a possibility that... Are you with me? In the sahih, there is a remote possibility that... No, in the one that's sahih, judged as sahih, there is a remote possibility that... he did. The Prophet ﷺ did not say it. It's not really a hadith. And the one that someone says da'if, there is a 10% chance that the Prophet ﷺ could have said it. It could be sahih, but technically speaking, we've just judged this. Okay? So therefore, then the scholars, then they say, look, when there's that 10% possibility, remote possibility of a da'if hadith, it could be. So therefore, then they go into the, look, we will talk about this later on, that if a hadith is da'if, that doesn't mean you always throw it away. What about that 10% possibility? And that 10% possibility, if you got another 20 indications of that 10% possibility, There's something in the Quran also supporting that 10% possibility. There's another hadith somewhere. There's a sahabi was acting, doing something which is similar to this hadith. There's another, so many indications that supports the idea that this 10% might actually be quite good 10% and might become. So that's why some imams might say, this hadith, despite being weak, we're going to act upon it, because it doesn't mean 100% it's the Prophet ﷺ didn't say it. And then there's so many other indications showing that maybe he did say it, etc., etc. So this is all technical things, sahih and da'if. So anyway, these are the five conditions of a sahih hadith. Okay, there was one or two other things as well about sahih hadith, but I think I'll just leave that. I think I mentioned that before as well. You know, I did mention this before, that sometimes, yeah, I'll just end with this last point about this. Sometimes a hadith is considered to be sahih earlier on, and later on it becomes weak. Yeah, you've got a hadith, say in the 4th century, there's a hadith, the Messenger sallallahu alayhi wa sallam said something, you're living in the 4th century, yes? What's your name again?
Sajid.
Yeah, Sajid is living in the 4th century. He heard it from somebody who heard from somebody who heard from a tabi'i, from a sahabi, Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam said this. All the narrators were scrutinized. In the 4th century, hadith for him is authentic. He said it to his student, and then he carried on. After 900 years, 1000 years, the chain has become long. Somebody in the chain, some fasiq guy, entered it. Now, after 900 years, the same hadith which was considered to be authentic in the 4th century became considered now as da'if later on. So the same hadith in the earlier time, in Imam Abu Hanifa's time, on Imam Malik's time, a hadith could be absolutely perfectly fine, because there's 3-4 narrators, I think I mentioned this briefly, and the same hadith, you might pick it up later on from Bukhari and Muslim, and Bukhari Muslim is like 200-300 years later. Okay? The same hadith in the 3rd century might be considered to be weak.
Chinese whisper then.
We won't. What do you mean Chinese? Yeah, no, but this is, yeah, in the chain. Maybe something like what you're saying. But this is the point. Anyway, so this was like a whole just summary of everything to do with sahih. I've explained everything to you in detail. The first point, basically going back, that he was saying that the first reason for difference of opinion is, when does a hadith qualify to be acted upon? When we're looking at hadith, does it qualify? The first thing you check is whether the hadith is authentic or not. Remember, we started, this whole course is about, when is a hadith fit enough to be acted upon? Are you with me? When is it fit enough to be acted upon? The first thing you look at, is it sahih or not? And then we looked at, what is sahih? What's the definition of the sahih? And then now, from next week, he's going to go into the differences of the imams in terms of these five conditions. So he'll look at the first. As far as the first condition is concerned, continuation of chain, there's a difference of opinion. Some say this is important for continuation of chain. Another imam says, no, this has to take place, or that has to take place. And when they disagree about that, one imam will consider a hadith to be sahih because the first condition has been met. And another imam, for him, the hadith will not be sahih because the condition has not been met, because they disagree in the application of the verse chain. This is what he's going to mention. Like, because it's fresh now, I'll give you that example. You know when he said continuation of the chain? Each person, remember, taking from the teacher. Remember I said one lived in Kufa, the student was born 20 years after the teacher died. So there's disconnection. Now there's a massive difference of opinion between the two main imams. Imam Bukhari and Imam Muslim, they disagree. There's a big ikhtilaf, Bukhari and Muslim. Imam Bukhari is more strict. He says that, look, if we want to, we'll talk about this next week, if we want to prove that this continuation, then it has to be proven with proper witnesses that this student has met this sheikh somewhere. It has to be proven. Give me 2-3 witnesses that he met him in this masjid or this place or this village or this city in Basra or Kufa. They have to meet. If their meeting is not established or proven anywhere, then I will not consider it to be continuation. Therefore, if I don't consider it to be continuation, hence the first condition is not met. If the first condition is not met, hence the hadith is not sahih. If the hadith is not sahih, then I'm not going to use it as proof for an issue of salah. Okay? Imam Muslim says, no, that's too strict. Imam Muslim goes really, like, he's a student of Imam Bukhari, but he opposes him and he brings his proofs and he gets really angry as well. And he says, like, why are you someone making this strict and this and that? Just them being in the same era, the possibility of meeting is enough. You don't have to prove that they met. As long as he was living in the same era as him and they both were in the same city and, you know, it's possible that they met. There's nothing showing that it wasn't possible. So the possibility of meeting is sufficient. Don't make it too difficult that they have to meet. So the possibility is enough. Now Imam Muslim might take a hadith. He might say, yeah, these two possibility of meeting, therefore, according to me, this first condition is met. If the first condition is met, hence the hadith is sahih. If the hadith is sahih, hence I can use it as evidence for such and such. Now there's one hadith, Imam Bukhari will say this hadith is weak, Imam Muslim will say this hadith is sahih. So just like you can't say Imam Bukhari, you can't tell Imam Muslim, why are you acting upon a weak hadith? Well, that's according to Imam Bukhari, not according to me. Do you understand the point? You can't tell Imam Muslim and turn him around and say to him, you're acting upon a weak hadith. That's like saying, you know, Imam Abu Hanifa is acting upon a weak hadith because Albani said. That's like the same thing. You're telling Imam Muslim, you're acting upon a weak hadith, but that's weak according to Imam Bukhari, but not according to Imam Muslim, because his criteria is different, not actual meeting, but the possibility of meeting, etc., etc., etc. There's going to be lots of details. I know, it was a lot to take, but inshallah, if you absorb it and go through it, inshallah. Is there any questions quickly? You've gone over time today, but...